On Commons People this week...
I think that we need to make sure that David Davis stays at the negotiating table.
David Davis stays, but for how long?
I'm injecting some honesty about where we are in the Labour Party.
Some honesty in politics?
I don't think sacking the people who are working today to solve the problem is going to solve the problem.
And don't worry, Chris Grayling's on the case. All of this and more in Commons People. Hello and welcome to Commons People, HuffPost UK's politics podcast with me, Owen Bennett, and this week I am joined by Mr. Paul Waugh.
Hello. Hello.
And Mr. Ned Symonds. How are you, Ned?
Not bad. How are you?
Thank you. Good. Good. Busy.
Just want to check.
Busy because of Mr. David Davis, who as, I'm currently halfway up the hill, has been marching us up and down along. But I mean, we're recording this about 2:45 on Thursday afternoon and we think he's not resigning. However, by 2:15 on Thursday afternoon, it could have all changed, couldn't it, Paul? This is David Davis we're talking about. Without wishing to go too much of the back and forth, this all comes down to the backstop. And this is the plan that comes into place if the UK and the EU haven't agreed or haven't got into place the customs arrangements for the Brexit deal. This is not what happens in case of a no deal, listener. I know it's confusing, but in case of a no deal, this is all out the window. Is that right? This is kind of like there's two versions of no deal now. There's no deal because we haven't reached a deal yet. And there's no deal because we're not even talking anymore. So now we're going to talk about no deal because we haven't reached a deal yet. Paul, what the hell is going on?
You've got to feel sorry for the ordinary punter, haven't you? Especially, you've got to feel sorry for the ordinary Leave voter who thinks that they've voted
there are no
to
ordinary
leave
leave
the
voters, Paul.
EU. There's millions of them, 70 million. They thought that they were voting to leave the EU, and they are going to leave the EU next March 29th. But we're going to stay in the EU, really, for at least 21 months in this transition period. And then after that, the whole point of this thing, the backstop that everyone keeps talking about, is that in case we can't come to any agreement, really, on about the way forward, there is at least a bare minimum, which means that even after 2021, we'll be able to sort of keep the lorries flowing and everything else.
Well, it's only to the end of 2021. It's not after 2021. They expect it to last a year. There's a lot of that word expects in the document that's come out just before we record this is doing an awful lot of work, isn't it?
It is.
We expect this to be done by December 2021.
And that's a brilliant sort of fudge, isn't it? It's great. And Brussels is all about fudge. There's more fudge here. But to me, what's interesting is that it's about the power that David Davis now wields. You know, a lot of the Eurosceptic MPs have been thinking, God, he's swallowed so much and he's really almost gone native. And what's he doing there? Is he really sticking up for us? And actually, all the way along, he said, look, stick with me. Trust me. You know, I'm going to make sure that we deliver a Brexit that you recognise. And the interesting about this is, oh, yeah, he hasn't got exactly what he wants, but he certainly, by pushing hard publicly, has shown the power that he still retains. Because everyone knows that if he'd walked, Theresa May would have been in trouble. And that's really him displaying the kind of leverage he says the PM should use against Brussels. He's actually using it against her. He's making threats and saying, look, you know, there is a serious consequence if you don't listen to me. And he's saying to her, you should be saying that to Brussels too. That's the great irony of it.
But the problem with this all, though, isn't it, Ned, is that actually this is just another can kick down the road. Because this is a draft proposal they put forward to the EU for the temporary backstop. It's got in there, we expect to be done by 2021. Okay, fine, you've got that. But it also has in there that they want to be able to sign and implement their own trade deal. UK can sign and implement its own trade deals and carry them through. Whilst at the same time, carrying out the trade deal of the EU, which is a customs union. Brussels aren't going to agree to that, are they?
No, I think the word expects in there also has to be looked at with what the EU would accept. I mean, the Irish Prime Minister has said that he won't accept any backstop that has a fixed end date. So by putting expected to end by the end of 2021, that's also because they probably realise the EU's already said we won't accept any backstop that has an end date. So whether they actually will get any agreement on it, you know, the British government's finally not even agreed, like you say, kick the can down the road a bit, and it might be dead on arrival once it gets to Brussels.
It shows diplomacy is all about words at the end of the day, but it is about actions too. And this is a diplomatic fudge to get the Tory party united ahead of next week, when they've got a really important vote on the EU withdrawal bill, and they want all their side united. They know that Labour are divided on some of that bill, and so the whole point for the PM is that she could fly off to the G7 summit in Canada having sorted this problem. But as I said earlier, it's been interesting to see David Davis just wield the clout that he's got, because he is a bit of a loner. There's no question. That's why a lot of people in the Tory Eurosceptic ERG group, the European Research Group, don't always trust him, because he and even his fellow cabinet ministers don't always trust him, because he does behave as if he's an individual, and he will carry a few people with him, but he'll keep close to his chest what he really, really thinks until he feels he needs to wield that power.
It's worth remembering, during the referendum campaign itself, he wasn't used by the official campaign vote leave. He was used a couple of times by the unofficial grassroots out campaign, but even then he kept himself quite a distance from it all, really. So when he was made Brexit Secretary, I think some people were a bit surprised by that, and Dominic Cummings, who's the campaign director of Vote Leave, has called him thick as mince.
Yeah, well, the thing about Davis is, though, he's proved a lot of his critics wrong by getting that job in the first place and sticking with it. And now, you can say, after months of feeling like he's been marginalised, and he's obviously been rather irritated that number 10 have got this guy, Ollie Robbins, who's the civil servant who's been taking the lead on a lot of Brexit negotiation. This was today Davis saying, I'm putting my foot down, look, the politicians matter here. I represent a certain constituency. There's no point in me doing this job unless you give me a bit more of what I want. And I think, personally, that word expects, although it is a diplomatic word, I can imagine that being on the splash in the Daily Mail. England expects ... with all the connotations of Nelson.
They've done that before, haven't they?
I'm not sure, but the word expects really matters now.
Jeremy Corbyn did quite a good job in PMQs this week, shock horror, it wasn't difficult, he was just pointing out to Theresa May all the things you said you'd have, but we haven't got yet, which is basically a position on Brexit, really. And this white paper, which is apparently going to make it all become clear, was supposed to be published, we thought it was published before the June summit. It doesn't look like that's going to happen now. There's no agreement on customs, no agreement on this, it's hard to believe, isn't it, that we are. I remember when this football started, and the Prime Minister's official spokesman saying to us, don't worry, we will have agreement, and all the capitals of all the states in the EU will have all signed this off and agreed it before we leave. It's just nowhere near, is it? It's unbelievable.
It will have to be ready by October.
They can't kick it
beyond October. That's for sure.
What happens then if we get to October and there's no signed the trade deal?
I mean, God knows. To be honest, that's not particularly big cutting insight, is it? And it's not really connected to your question, but I thought it was a nice kind of, as an aside, in kind of how Theresa May hasn't been able to decide anything. She was supposed to attend the opening of a play about D-Day last night, which is a nice sort of metaphor for her Brexit plan going well, but had to pull out because it was all going to shit in the cabinet.
And she's been doing all these private talks in her Commons office, not in number 10. It's quite interesting. The other little subplot here is that Robbie Gibb, who's the Prime Minister's Director of Communications
and Strategy. Not the former Bee Gees.
Not a Bee Gees star, but even more important in number 10, is the one who's obviously tried to keep the show on the road for the Prime Minister. He's himself basically a committed Eurosceptic. And a lot of MPs see him as the conscience of Brexit in number 10. And it's interesting that today, in the middle of this whole sort of drama and the melodrama about David Davis, will he quit, won't he quit, he was the one sent to the DEXU department after the Prime Minister had had a chat with David Davis privately. He was the one sent in, and there was a very heated exchange in the building, I understand, in which he basically read the Riot Act and said, look, you've gone so far, you can't go any further. And the subplot is that Stuart Jackson, who is David Davis's chief of staff, and Robbie Gibb have known each other for a very long time, more than 30-odd years, because they did exactly the same university course at Royal Holloway in London, and the course was Economics and Public Administration. And so they know each other incredibly well. It just shows that in politics, those little connections from many years ago, whether it's Sajid Javid knowing Tim Montgomery and all the other people like Rob Halfon, all those university connections at some point actually do kick in.
The word you're looking for there is establishment, I believe. Let's move on now, shall we, to the Labour Party. Because the Tories aren't the only one with problems, he says, with everyone says all the time, like it's some sort of amazing insight. Labour has introduced a new Brexit policy this week. They kind of have. It's a plan to tie the UK to the EU single market after Brexit. It's a bid to unite Remain MPs in the Commons. They've unveiled an amendment to a future Brexit-related legislation that would ensure the UK shares minimum standards, rights and protections with the EU. It also calls for shared UK-EU institutions, although they haven't actually explained what that was. It would mean the UK having to follow Brussels rules, potentially including freedom movement of people. Obviously, it didn't go down well with Labour because this is Labour. Here's Keir Starmer on the Today programme talking about it.
I'm injecting some honesty about where we are in the Labour Party. Chukramuna was on a moment ago saying that what you needed was cross-party amendments that command support on both sides of the House. He knows, and others who are critical on this know, that this amendment does not command that support in their own party. I've been talking to colleagues for the last two or three weeks to gauge the views across our party. I wish I could report that we had complete unity on all amendments,
so
but we're not in that position.
So you're saying you think you'd...
And Keir there was mentioning Chukramuna. Let's have a listen to him.
There isn't actually been a big change. There's been a welcome change in tone, I think. But substantially, the Labour Party's policy is the same, which is it seeks full access to the single market in the same way as the government. It wishes in certain respects to continue to participate in EU agencies and apply some of its standards like the government. But it is not where I and a number of other colleagues would like it to be, which is for us to stay in Europe's economic area.
So this sort of seething melodrama in the Labour Party. So the basic premise is this, is that Labour don't like... The Labour front bench don't like the EEA amendment, so they don't want the Norway model.
Yes.
And that amendment is coming before MPs, we think, Tuesday or Wednesday, right? So they put forward their own amendment, which is not coming before MPs Tuesday or Wednesday. They're going to put that on a bill in the, sometime in the future. Some move on from that. Which is basically saying the same thing. Chukramuna doesn't like it, because Chukramuna, Ned, he didn't put it forward himself, or what?
I mean, so the main problem that the kind of really pro-Remain, pro-EEA Labour MPs have is they think that the Labour front bench amendment is basically the same position as the government has. And the reason Keir Starmer today was saying we're not going to vote whip Labour MPs to vote for the EEA because Labour's so split we won't win the vote. But people like Amunna say no, we would win the vote because there's enough Tory rebels like Anna Soubry and so on to make up for any Labour MPs that would vote against it. I think important to this is really that Jeremy Corbyn and so on probably don't really want to be part of the single market because they see that really is about immigration, and their understanding is, the Brexit vote was largely about immigration. If you're part of the single market, you've got to have free movement of people.
Isn't that the more than Caroline Flint? Wasn't Jeremy Corbyn more state aidy kind of
I think
club?
In the analysis, I think, of why Labour wouldn't be so kind of push, from the front saying let's stay in the single market as opposed to the customs union discussion is the connection to immigration. And I don't know if this argument that, we can't win the vote on the EEA, so we're not going to bother trying to whip our MPs to back it on the amendment. I think the idea they're not doing that just because of Labour splits might be a little bit disingenuous.
Well, what's interesting is that Keir Starmer has had a really important role in all this in trying to, bridge the divide within Labour and trying to heal those divisions. Again, just as the Tories are looking forward next week to uniting, so is Labour. And that's really what Starmer's all about. After he published his new formulation, his tweak of Labour policy, which is the softest Brexit they've had so far, it's worth not forgetting that. It's really, really important
they
what they've
moving,
done.
Moving closer and closer, aren't they?
So although it's not what a lot of the Remainer ultras really want, it is a significant step towards a softer Brexit. And Starmer, yesterday, I understand, had a series of private meetings with many, many Labour MPs from different bits of the country, different wings of the party. And there was one particular meeting where of MPs in Leave areas, where people like Stephen Kinnock turned up and were kind of hoping that they could push the EEA amendment. And there was a massive pushback from people like Caroline Flint and Wayne David as well, who's writing for the HuffPost as well, and to express that constituency of Labour MPs who are in Leave areas, who say actually migration really matters to my voters. And if you go down the EA route, then really we risk losing those votes.
But there is also a constituency of Labour MPs in Leave areas who want to stay in the single market. So there is, even with that, it's difficult, isn't it, to say, oh, all Leave area MPs think this. So
no, that's why it was interesting. He had a meeting specifically of Leave area MPs, and within that meeting there was a division. And to him, to Starmer, that confirmed why his policy was the best way forward, because it's at least one way of uniting them.
I mean, a lot of time and effort is spent by people like me, nothing else to do, trying to get my head around Labour's Brexit position. But why am I bothering there? Because they're not in government.
I don't know, but well, most know. Things you do, to
they're
honest,
not, they're not in government. They're not going to be in charge of negotiations. Their job, really, is to scrutinise what the government's doing, not to offer a coherent alternative, right? If their job is to say, look, Theresa May, you said 2 years ago we'd have as close trade as possible and a frictionless thing. You know, where are we with that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that by publishing this amendment, by kind of, as we've been saying, incrementally becoming more and more soft, that in itself is pushing the government, and that the kind of outcome of that is scrutinising government policies. That does have an impact on what the government does. But mostly, as you said, it's about politics and about internal party management.
But you have to have an alternative. If you're just putting yourself forward as an alternative government, it's completely irresponsible. It's not in the national interest. And I think it's bad politics not to draft your own alternative. And if that alternative does look a bit like the government, but actually they would argue it doesn't, because it involves a customs union and a single market. And in a way, Labour have been allowed to enter this territory by Theresa May vacating it. Liam Fox, at the beginning of the year, with really, really significant move, persuaded Theresa May not to say that the UK should be part of a single market or a customs union. And Labour has filled that gap. And, you know, if there is an imminent general election, who knows, with David Davis, the resignation swirling around, that yet again reminded people that you've got a hung parliament. It's relatively easy to get a new general election or call a general election if there's a crisis. And if you're going to have a general election, you've got to have a policy.
I saw outside 22 committee this week, the meeting of the Tory backbenchers, when the Chief Whip went in to say that they're going to do this e-withdrawal bill over 2 days now, instead of one marathon 12-hour session. And he came out and he turned to his aide and went, right, OK, off to the DUP now. And it was just so such a crystallised, wonderful version of how government works. Got the Tories on side, oh, now off to the DUP. And I thought yeah. It was wonderful. Let's move on, shall we? Because let's move on to Chris Grayling. Chris Grayling has announced an inquiry into him, well, not into himself, but into whether train companies are at a fault for the timetable chaos affecting thousands of passengers. Trains continue to be delayed following the biggest train timetable change in decades, amid mass cancellations on Northern and Go Via Thames Link Railway. In Parliament, Grayling said he will not hold back in taking action against the industry if they are not meeting their contractual obligations. But he faced criticism from both sides of the House, with Labour MPs calling on him to resign. Here is Nicholas Soames first, followed by Rachel Reeves.
I suggest to him, ask him, if he is aware that the rail service to East Grinstead, which he has always taken an interest in, has finally fallen over completely, that trains from Haywards Heath, Wivelsfield and Burgess Hill are shorter and more overcrowded, that people's private lives are being destroyed, and this whole thing is an absolute disaster and must be put right.
Can I just say frankly to the Secretary of State, passengers have lost faith in him. Isn't it about time he step aside and allow someone else to do the job who can fix this problem?
So HuffPost, we've done a lot of work on it this week. There was a really good thing where a lot of the local papers got together and based the same headline, which is, you know, enough is enough. Grayling is just seen... I mean, why is he so bad, Ned? That's not me being like offensive. That is... I mean, everything he's ever done has always been overturned, right?
Yeah, but he obviously doesn't agree and doesn't care. Because, like you said, he's criticised so much for every cabinet position he has. He doesn't always seem really that ruffled by it, though. You know, you don't really see him looking particularly harangued, even when he was getting kind of quite, you know, got after by Tory MPs during that statement in the Commons about the trains. It wasn't just Labour MPs, like you mentioned. It was a lot of backbench Tories. You had Michael Fallon basically telling him to get a grip, the former Defence Secretary. But he never really comes across looking like he's that kind of bothered by it, in public at least.
He looks like a punched punch bag, doesn't he? He really does. I mean, in both politically and sort of physically, he looks like just, all right, I'm going to stand here, you just have a go at me, I'm going to absorb all this stuff, and then I'm going to survive at the end of it. Because he, to be fair to him, what he was saying does have some sort of rationality. He was basically saying, look, the government has a responsibility through Network Rail, and that's the state-owned bit of this that have really cocked up, let's be honest. They delayed all of their crucial works, which had a knock-on effect. The private sector have cocked up because they knew this was coming down the track, knew that Network Rail had delayed, and they didn't do anything, didn't raise any alarm about it, and so didn't tell ministers. The people that really suffer are the poor people that we've done lots on this week, which is people, you know, being told that they've missed a job opportunity, or they're late for an interview, or they're getting their pay docked, or their kids are not getting to school on time. So they're the people who are really suffering. So, and I think it was quite smart of Grayling not to make it sound like he was the victim.
But also, I don't think he particularly looked like his kind of any, you know, action he's going to take. I don't think many voters are going to believe that he's on their side in this.
Well, they're having a review, aren't they? Well, it's the classic yes minister exactly. response to everything. Let's have a review.
You could have a situation where this could be happening and the minister could come across, at least PR-wise, as if they're kind of taking control of it and really going to sort it out. I don't think that's particularly the message that came across this week.
Speaking as two Southerners, and Paul is basically an adopted Southerner now. You know, I played the clip there from Nicola Soames. We talked about Michael Fallon, you know, two MPs in the south of England. Is it only because it started to really affect passengers in the south now that the media, Parliament are taking notice? Is this been going on in the north world, or is that just a kind of slight lazy?
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that, actually. I mean, if you look at what's happening on Southern Rail, which is the line between Brighton and London, which is, you know, perhaps the most kind of southern thing there could be, that's been going on for a long time. So I think the fact now it's affected more of the country has made it a bigger issue, because there are now more MPs, particularly in the north, that it's affecting their constituents. So I don't think in this situation it's actually the way round.
I think actually it matters more that it's happened in the north and in the Midlands, because, and in Leeds, because don't forget, politically, all those seats in the south are safe.
Yeah,
you can have loads of Michael Fallon's getting up and Grant Shapps is attacking you, but you'll still have your Tory majority. If you're Pudsey, if you're someone like Stuart Andrew, if you're somewhere on the fringes of Lancashire in those key swing marginal seats, you know, you've got Ben Wallace, who's a minister, with a seat up there. If your seats are under threat because your local constituents literally can't get to work, then you're in trouble.
Yeah, whereas the Southern line, which is kind of runs where I grew up, which is Sussex, Surrey, they're not, Tories aren't losing those seats, even if the trains stop working entirely.
What I do hope off the back of this, though, wouldn't it be great if there was some national anger about the lack and the appalling state of bus services nationally. There's always a big outrage.
Andrew Adonis, go on.
There's always that's the point. Andrew Adonis loves trains, whereas actually buses is what a lot of people, particularly from poorer backgrounds, rely on and have been decimated in the rural areas and in the fringes of a lot of big cities. People rely on them, and yet there's been no national outcry about that. And what was it going to take for MPs to stand up for 3 hours to harangue the Transport Minister about that? Maybe, but maybe this will wake people up a bit about the whole state of transport.
Well, speaking of things to wake you up, this week's quiz.
Oh, great.
Hey, that's right, isn't it? Jeremy Hunt, he says carefully, is now the longest serving health secretary since the NHS was founded in 1948. I want you to name me every health... No. Okay.
You've done that before.
Have I? Okay. Well, we're now going to do longest people in jobs.
What are the two options?
There's no
longest serving HuffPost political someone.
Yeah, Ned. Ned, right? But, you know, so
worked here for 75 years.
The longest serving since 1945, who was the longest serving foreign secretary? You can have a stab in the dark, or I can give you some options.
Options are always good.
Ernie Bevin, Geoffrey Howe, or Douglas Hurd. Great names. Three great names there.
I'd be tempted by Ernie Bevin,
I'm going to say Douglas Hurd.
Ooh, Douglas Hurd.
Just because...
The reason I'm tempted by Ernie Bevin...
What are you thinking about Bevin, Paul? Go on.
Is because Nye Bevin was the longest serving health secretary until Hunt.
Yes.
And that is because Nye Bevin...
No, he wasn't actually. He was the longest serving Labour.
Labour. But he was there for a long time, like 6 years or something. Yeah. So, and that was... Bevin overlapped with him. I'm going to go for Bevin because he overlapped at the same time.
Because he's got the same name as Bevin?
No, because he was in that same 45-51 government.
He was, Paul, and he did serve for 45-51. However, he's not the longest serving. It is Mr. Geoffrey Howe, 1889, 2,236 days.
That's a long
time.
Then Douglas Hurd, 2,078. And then Ernie Bevin, 2,052. Who is the longest serving Defence Secretary? And I'm saying Secretary when it was created in 1964, before not a minister.
Not Minister of War.
So, was it Jeff Hoon? I know.
No.
I just love saying that. Was it Dennis Healy? Or was it Peter Carrington? Hoon, Healy, Carrington, Sessions. Go on.
Carrington.
I'm going to say Carrington purely because of his brilliant trivia. He was 99 yesterday, and he's the oldest, I think he's the oldest Tory peer. I think he is.
Right. Unless, of course, you're listening on Friday, in which case he was 99 2 days ago.
Fury.
And
yes.
So on.
What? Yeah.
Yes.
The answer is Dennis Healy, 64-70. Jeff Hoon was 99-12. Jeff Hoon's the second longest.
Really?
And then Carrington.
Whatever.
Yeah. Wow. Then Carrington, 774. Longest serving transport secretary since 2002. Before then, it was all divided up. And all right. Stuff. Was it Alistair Darling? Was it Patrick McLaughlin? Or was it Ruth Kelly? Again, I laughed at the name.
Ruth Kelly.
I know.
I think McLaughlin.
Oh.
What was the first one?
Alistair Darling.
Darling. I'm going to go for Darling.
Yes, Darling.
Because Darling.
It was Alistair Darling. 226.
This.
With 1,438 days, just 28 days more than Patrick McLaughlin. 2016, Ruth Kelly did it with 434 days. There's no prizes of second place, Ned. Don't get me. And finally, Education Secretary since 1964. Who was the longest serving? Was it Kenneth Baker? Was it Mr. Michael Gove? Or was it Keith Joseph?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Tricky. I'm going to say Kenneth Baker.
Kenneth Baker.
Because there's lots of... He's remembered.
He's remembered fondly.
Who are the other two again?
Gove.
Yeah.
Have you heard of him?
Yeah.
And Keith Joseph.
Oh, I don't know. Keith Joseph.
Yeah, it was Keith Joseph.
Oh, great. I knew that. I wasn't a guess.
And then Gove was 10-14. And then Baker was 86-89.
So, and he did a lot more than the others.
Yeah. Well, not
in
more
that
than
short
Gove.
Period.
Come on. Gove did a lot. Find out more in about April next year.
Anyway,
So what?
Find out things you already knew.
Yeah. Find out things you've read elsewhere.
Find out more if you're a GCSE student, that's for sure.
Satire, innit? And Paul there, getting in. That's it, innit, this week?
That's it.
Is there anything else to talk about?
It's a whirlwind of a week.
There's been a load. I mean, there was a lot this week we could have talked about. We could have talked a lot about abortion. We could have talked a lot. There's slow stuff.
A bit busy, isn't it?
Carillion. There was Dominic Cummings. There was all this sort of mad stuff going on this week. Corbyn was good at PMQs, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
And he chose Brexit, again, the right decision. Yeah, because you just keep plugging away at government divisions, you know. And he actually ad-libbed rather well this week.
He didn't say Heathrow at all. Justin Greening's
huge. Yeah, and Labour, what are Labour going to do? Are they bluffing about saying the tests have been met? We'll see.
This is good. This is a bit of the podcast where we remember all the stuff we forgot to talk about.
Is this podcast uncut?
This is podcast uncut. Yeah, thanks everyone for listening. And we will. You'll hear from us next week. Goodbye.